Syria, Iran, Sudan. Missouri's state treasurer doesn't want any of your tax dollars going there. Why not?
They provide cash to Hezbollah. They provide weapons to terrorists who kill American soldiers, who seek to wipe Israel off the map. And so I'm very sensitive to this.
Eric Schmidt on his new work as the state's CFO this week on Statehouse Blend, Missouri. From KCUR 89.3, this is Statehouse Blend, Missouri. I'm Brian Ellison. We'll talk with State Treasurer Eric Schmidt in a moment. But first, in Jefferson City, it's a week for making sausage. Lots of bills working through the process, some that have been in that process for quite a long time. Take Real ID. Since 2005, Missouri's been resisting federal standards for driver's licenses and for sharing certain information with the U.S. government. Now we're one of the last five states without Real ID, and come next year, Missourians won't be able to get through airport security without a passport if nothing changes. Well, a House bill giving drivers the option of getting a federally compliant license moved forward earlier this week and seems headed for passage. But Republicans concerned about privacy issues slowed momentum for a bill on the Senate side, which didn't sit well with sponsor Ryan Silvey, another Republican from Kansas City.
I think it's interesting that those that are on the other side of this issue are claiming to be protectors of freedom. And the way they're going about it is by limiting the choices of everyday Missourians. So I think that's a little bit of cognitive dissonance.
And that wasn't the only time this week Missouri legislators debated whether to join the rest of the country on something. 49 states have a prescription drug monitoring program, a PDMP. That's a database accessible to doctors and pharmacists showing prescription history. Medical experts say it's essential for preventing opioid addiction, but standing in its way for the last few sessions, one senator.
The question is, should everybody in the country give up their liberty of privacy of not having their meds on the government database accessible by 30,000 people so that less than 1% of the people would be caught?
That's Rob Schaff, a Republican from St. Joseph, at a live taping of this program a year ago. Still, this week on the Senate floor, he said he was throwing in the towel by offering his own version. A PDMP light, if you will. It notifies users of possible multiple prescriptions, but doesn't provide full histories and dumps the info after 6 months. The Senate advanced his bill 20-13, but advocates and sponsors on the House side say they'll still be pushing for something a little more potent. And finally, the Missouri legislature is one of 12 with pending bills that would follow North Carolina in adopting a so-called bathroom bill, requiring people to use the restroom or locker room of the sex on their birth certificate, regardless of their gender identity. Response to that law, passed last March, has so far cost North Carolina the NBA All-Star Game and $84 million in convention business. But Senator Ed Emery, the Republican sponsor of the bill in Missouri, thinks schools need guidance to ensure privacy and safety for kids.
I've talked to superintendents who acknowledge that they have students in their schools that would fit into these categories, and they're not sure just exactly what they should be doing to accommodate them.
No vote yet on the measure, and no word on its potential impact on the state's economic development. That's a topic near and dear to the man in charge of the state's money, Treasurer Eric Schmidt. Joining us this week in the KCUR production studio is the 46th treasurer of the state of Missouri, Eric Schmidt. He's a Republican. He's about 6 weeks into the job. Treasurer Schmidt, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
It's really good. Congratulations on
thanks.
That.
Thanks. Yeah, it's an exciting time, and the statewide race was a lot of fun, and now getting settled into the office, so it's great.
Got carried away and forgot to acknowledge my colleague, KCUR's Dan Margulies, who is also with us today. Hi, Dan.
Quite all right. Hello, Brian.
You know, I do want to ask, I know that you actually share space when you're in Jeff City with a bunch of your former colleagues in the legislature, as I understand. This has been publicly reported on our air before. Senator Jason Holzman said that you have forsworn the treasurer's mansion to live with.
A man of the people. That's who I am. And you know what I really enjoyed about the Senate in my time there, my 8 years there, my two terms was, you really do get a chance. It's a small enough body. There's 34 members where you really get to know people, and you can create some really unique coalitions, bipartisan coalitions. And I know it doesn't make the headlines all the time because it's not the stuff that probably sells papers. But, you know, I'd say 90% of the stuff we do is really kind of blocking and tackling and working together. And, you know, I worked on, you know, some issues, autism insurance reform and municipal court reform and sort of post-Ferguson. And, those are some unique coalitions that you can form, and a lot of that it's personal relationships. And so I always enjoyed that about being in public life, and look to continue that in the treasurer's office.
The group of guys who live together there in Jeff City, would you describe the housing arrangement as more Animal House, more Dead Poets Society?
I'm afraid it's not exciting in any way, shape, or form.
Revenge
it's just
of the Nerds.
People looking for a place to sleep, I think, is probably the deal. So I don't want to give anybody the impression that this is an exciting arrangement. It's just where you go when you're not in the Capitol, basically.
Purely functional.
Yeah.
Well, I do want to ask you about what it's like for you in the Capitol now as the state treasurer. And this is a question that seems so basic as to perhaps be insulting, so I apologize. But what in the world does the state treasurer do for our listeners?
That's a great question. So if you think of the constitutional officers as kind of a board of directors, which is really how it's set up, you've got a CEO, a governor, mm-hmm. The lieutenant governor. You've got a lawyer, right? The lawyer for the board, which is the AG, the secretary of state that does ministerial things and elections and those sorts of things. And the treasurer is really kind of positioned as the state's CFO. And so you really have an opportunity. I chaired the Economic Development Committee in the Senate for 6 years, which in a term limited world is about as long as you can serve as a chairman.
Right.
And one of the things that really attracted me to the office was, my desire to continue to serve my state. But also, you can have a longer range view. We do year-to-year budgets, right? So you don't sometimes get the opportunity to have that longer-term view as you do as the state CFO, as state treasurer. And so it gives you an opportunity to work on a lot of really interesting things, things that affect people's daily lives. I mean, we administer the state's 529 college savings plan, and one of our goals is to certainly increase enrollment in that program. I am the father of a 12-year-old son with some pretty profound disabilities. Stephen is nonverbal on the autism spectrum, has seizures nearly every day. And so when I was in the Senate, talk about those bipartisan coalitions, passed the ABLE Act, which is a way for families to save for the long-term needs of a loved one with a disability like they would for college. And so we'll be rolling that out, these ABLE accounts. So the treasurer administers that. The treasurer is also on the Mosher's board, the state pension board, and there's some emerging issues there that, again, are not partisan in any way, shape, or form. We had an op-ed in the Kansas City Star recently about the underfunded nature of our state's largest pension.
We want to talk about that.
But
it's interesting to me that it is a partisan office at all. From what you describe, it isn't. Most of what you're doing is implementing and carrying out legislation, statutes, constitutional provisions. Why does it matter whether it's a Republican or a Democrat in the office?
Well, I think people deserve somebody that is working on behalf of all 6 million Missourians, not just the ones that voted for him or he or she. So I take that seriously, and there's no partisan nature of the 529 plan or any of the things that we talked about. I mean, clearly I have my own political philosophy and ideology, but as far as the core functions of the office, a lot of those things don't matter. I think that, being a fiscal conservative probably does color how I view a lot of the issues as relates to the office or kind of where our budget sits or some of the things that we should be looking at long term. But what
could you do differently as the treasurer because you're a fiscal conservative?
I think, you can advocate for certain things that are maybe not in the four corners of the office, but that bully pulpit that you have as a statewide elected official. There's only 6 of us.
Mm-hmm.
And to advocate for pro-growth policies that I believe in.
So I want to jump in here, Eric, and ask you, because it is true that most of the functions of the treasurer's office are really nonpartisan in nature, and doesn't matter whether you're a Republican or a Democrat in carrying out those functions. But as you say, there are certain aspects of the job that indubitably are colored by your philosophy. So let's jump into the question of the state's pension funds that
Sure.
you wrote an op-ed in the Kansas City Star about a few weeks ago that Brian just now alluded to. You say correctly that the state's largest pension funds have a big, big underfunding problem.
Mm.
Now, you did not suggest in the op-ed, I noticed, how we might fix them. And, of course, this is where perhaps your fiscal conservatism, I'm assuming you're a fiscal conservative, might come
that
into
would be
play.
Correct, yeah.
So can you tell us what kind of solutions you might suggest to address this problem of underfunded pensions?
It wasn't that long ago that if you looked at it, you saw that Missouri's pension fund was sort of like 85% funded. Well, that's changed dramatically. If you look at where we're really at it, we're 64% funded. But the problem is much deeper than that in the sense that assumes a rate of return that's close to 8%. And for anybody listening, that's just an unreasonable. And I also give credit to my predecessor, Clint Zweifel, who was a Democrat, was pushing for that number to be lowered as well to get. And I think
where does that number come from, by the way?
Because usually most funds would use a 4% right. or something like that.
Yeah, and I think you got to be in the sixes to be anywhere in the neighborhood of being realistic here. But we're not. We're in the high sevens. Right. And if you do that, then if you assume that rate of return is a much more realistic number, we're probably closer to like 50% funded. And that's a big issue when you've promised a benefit essentially to state employees, but you don't have the money to fulfill that obligation. And so my job, I think, early on here is to have that board be as transparent as possible about where we're really at. And I think the first order of business is to build a coalition among that board to say, look, let's get to a more realistic number. Let's be honest with taxpayers and the beneficiaries who are in that system, who are part of that system, about where we're at. And there's a couple things we should do. That's the first one. The second thing we ought to do is, I think, to have a goal of not being 80% funded, but being 100% funded. I mean, if we're going to be honest with people, right? Like, nobody says, I'm going to, you know, if I go to the store and I'm going to buy groceries, I'm going to pay 80% and that's my goal. I mean, you have to come up with the cash, right? So that's where we're at right now. As far as solutions go, I really am open-minded about this. I think you need to bring as many stakeholders to the table as possible. Get around the state, find out what the best ideas are. I was at a national conference last week where you had Republicans and Democrat treasurers, the National Association, and I'm on the pension committee, and I wanted to be on that pension committee because I want to learn more about what other states are doing, because we're not unique. Missouri is not unique. I mean, you look at a state like Kentucky, they're 17% funded. You look at Illinois, which I know in Kansas City here look more to Kansas, but from the St. Louis side, you look to Illinois. Nobody wants to emulate where Illinois is with all this stuff. So there are states that are doing better. There are states that are doing worse. I think the key right now is let's just get the best ideas on the table and try to build a coalition of what that looks like.
Can you throw out an idea or two that you would favor?
I don't want to color the process right now with what I think the solution is, because I think we have to understand the gravity of the problem first.
Are there any solutions that don't involve throwing more money at it?
Well,
I mean, is one question.
Well, look, I mean, I voted for this in 2010. We had, for new employees, we extended the vesting period from 5 years to 10 years and also a 4% contribution for new employees. That's part of a solution, right? I mean, but it's a step. So I think we need
to. And a painful one. State employee works for 9 years without being vested in their pension fund.
Right. Well, we didn't affect anyone who was currently in. So this was all new hires. It was
only
prospective. So anybody that, and I think that's a realistic way to look at this. When you make a promise to somebody, I think it's realistic to say for somebody coming in, they kind of know the benefit of the bargain. And that's probably where the solutions mm-hmm. are going to probably arrive from here. And what can we do? And the other thing is, look, millennials, It's a different environment. It used to be a generation ago. I mean, we're in a very disruptive sort of economic time. If you look at this sort of more philosophically, you've kind of like hunters and gatherers. Then you have the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution, like the big tool economy. And then whatever it is that we're in right now, that nobody really knows what to call it yet. It's the technology age. It's the information age. I'm 41. It's around that time, late 70s, where we're at now. And the point of that is, a generation ago, people expected to work in the same place maybe for their entire working lifetime, maybe two. Now, millennials will change careers 4 times before they're 30. So I think that the way that we look at this, we have to probably be a little bit more flexible about how we deal with that. Now, does that mean having from 10 to 5? No, I think it probably means empowering people. And I also think paying state employees more than what we're paying them right now is part of the solution, too. Yeah. So,
you mentioned earlier that you have something of a bully pulpit as the treasurer. It may not be part of the constitutional duties of the job, but you have the opportunity to influence legislation. And you've taken advantage of that most prominently so far in your tenure on the right to work bill, now law, that, of course, prohibits requiring people to join unions. You came and testified in support of that, saying that it would benefit economic growth. Can you talk a little bit about how you can be so certain of that, given that there have been states around Missouri that are right-to-work states that have not actually grown at the same rate as Missouri has, given that there was overall growth during that period, so it's hard to pin exactly why the growth was taking place, whether it's right to work legislation or something else. Why was that such an important issue for you to weigh in on?
Yeah, and I think it's important to say that look, nothing is an apples-to-apples comparison. I acknowledge that. I mean, you're not going to find any state with exactly the same tax climate, exactly the same labor climate. I mean, it's really hard to find those apples-to-apples comparisons. But from a purely economic perspective, if you look at the states that are doing really well, okay, the two things that they have in common is they are low-tax, right-to-work states. That's the facts. And so Indiana, for example, has done this. They have higher union membership after becoming a right-to-work state. So, again, there's no apples-to-apples comparison here. But I think if you want to have the best business climate possible, and look, I also think it's important for people to acknowledge, which can be very difficult in this age of 140 characters here, for people to acknowledge that on both sides of the issue here, I think that we have to accept that people want to see our state do well. I have three young kids. I want them to have great educational opportunities here. I want them to, selfishly, I want them to live nearby. I want them to have a fulfilling career in our state. So my job, the way I see it, is to just talk straight on this. And from my experience in talking to these site selectors, being a right-to-work state is an important factor.
Right-to-work is the law of the state at this point. I guess I'm interested in kind of in your role as treasurer, having sort of weighed in on that particular bill, what other bills, either in the current session or down the road, do you see as important enough, relevant enough to the economic health of the state that feel to you, whether they passed or not or failed to pass, would have an economic impact on the state?
I mean, there a lot of them will have an economic impact on the state one way or another. I think, you know, we're talking about an educated workforce. Anything we can do to create more educational opportunities in the state is sort of in the bandwidth of the office, and certainly something that we're supportive of. I'm a big believer in lower taxes. I have a record of that, you know. And
tort reform is a big priority of the governor.
Sure,
talks about it as a pro-business step.
I think there's a lot of legal reform. As a lawyer, I can tell you there's some changes that need to happen in the legal environment. But I try to take a balanced view of all of this. But I think, you know, having sponsored and passed two of the largest tax cuts in the history of the state, I believe in that. I grew up as a Jack Kemp Republican. And I know that, you know, in Kansas City, there's a lot of differing views on that. And there's a lot going on in Kansas. And I don't presume to know all the intricacies and nuances of what's happening in Topeka.
Well, but you read my mind there, because I was going to ask you something about that. Because when you were running as a candidate for the office, you said one of your priorities was to create more jobs through tax cuts, particularly for small businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to ask you whether Kansas serve as a cautionary lesson about that? I mean, it enacted massive tax cuts, as we all know, and exempted hundreds of thousands of small businesses from having to pay the state income tax. But it doesn't appear that it created many jobs as a result. And it's now dealing, of course, with a massive budget hole. So what makes you think that same approach would work in Missouri?
Well, I think, first of all, if you've looked at any broad-based tax relief, and I'm talking about JFK to Ronald Reagan, you've seen an economic boom, okay? As a state matter, it's a different universe. So you're looking at, and again, you're getting into different factors. I was very proud to be a part of what Missouri did, I guess a few years ago now, back in 2014, when we overrode the governor for the first income tax cut in nearly 100 years. I just think that individuals know better how to spend their money than government does. Now, that doesn't mean I'm not an anarchist. It doesn't mean that there's no government. But I think that, look, we've got a nearly $28 billion budget. I think there's enough room for a lot of the priorities if we get down to brass tacks and make those actual priorities. Now, what's important to note, the distinction between what Missouri did and Kansas did, is we had revenue triggers. We, you know, it's essentially over a five-part series to lower the income tax rate. One of the things that I was certainly a big believer in was for the small businesses, and if you look at how those businesses are organized, and the auto repair shop, the dry cleaner, they're all LLCs, LLPs, closely held companies. What we've never done, and if all you ever do is lower the corporate income tax rate, you never touch those small businesses. Mm-hmm. So I think we had a very measured, reasonable tax reform that lowers their tax liability by 25% over a period of years, where you would have to realize, I think those revenue triggers were like $150 million, you know, times five, you'd almost have to have $1 billion worth of growth
before you'd see that kind of tax relief. Mm-hmm. And I'm okay with that. I support that. So, and again, that's different than what Kansas did. I'll let that. Now, it depends on what economic measure you're looking at. My understanding, and again, it's been a couple years since I've really followed what Kansas had, but I know that the number of business filings had increased. So depending on where you're looking at on that curve,
of course,
the analysis can be different.
Filings had increased, one would argue, because all these companies were converting to LLCs in order to avail themselves of the
it's naive to think that there is a fiscal note with Missouri doing nothing. Right. Okay, and that was the thing that I think was lost in this debate too. Where, look, if you're a mechanic, and you have a store on State Line Road, and you're on the Missouri side, and you're in the city of Kansas City, and you can save 7% by moving to the other side of State Line Road, I think it's naive to not think that people are rational economic actors. Now, I agree.
I'm not sure that's
well, I think people will make those decisions. Now, what you're not going to see sometimes, a lot of people are locked into long-term leases, right? Certainly in downtown Kansas City. And so I want Missouri to be as competitive as possible. I want to do it in a responsible way, but I've always been an advocate for tax reform.
One of the other areas where you do have a constitutional duty, where you have to act, is on the investment of state funds. You talked a lot about this in the campaign.
Yeah.
The $3.8 billion investment portfolio of the state. You've now been in the job, I know, only 6 weeks, but you did talk in the campaign about some of the things you would do as the person leading the investment of those funds. Have you made any changes to how those funds are presently invested already? Do you have a sense of where you're going to go with that?
Well, we talked about the campaign, and one of the things that we want to do is we want to make sure that we're investing more in Main Street here in Missouri than in Wall Street. And that is a process that we're going through to make sure that being in Kansas City this week, we're talking to Hawthorne Bank and some local banks about what can the treasurer's office do. We have a low interest loan program, the linked deposit program. That's a discount essentially for up to $720 million a year in small business and ag loans. And right now, only about $200 million of that's being utilized. And so that's one way that we can, at a low cost, provide capital that ends up. And one of the things we want to do longer term is reposition those in many ways of being responsive to the agricultural economy, which is such a big part of what we do in Missouri, exports and otherwise. But also, general small business is kind of how it's classified. But you have a rebirth of an entrepreneurial spirit on both sides of the state and all places in between. But I would say especially here in Kansas City, some of the things that are happening with startups, this stuff just wasn't happening 10, 15 years ago. And that's really exciting. That's kind of a new economy that's emerging. And so I think that program, especially in a rising interest rate environment, is going to become more and more relevant. So that's one thing that we can have a role to play with economic development. And one of the things that we certainly talked about on the campaign trail was making sure we have a tariff-free investment policy. This was something that was started back in 2004 when Sarah Steelman was first elected. And I believe in that. That was certainly an issue in the campaign. Well,
could you elaborate a little?
Yeah, if you're designated as a state sponsor of terrorism, I just don't think that any Missouri tax dollars should be invested in any company that does business with a state sponsor of terrorism.
So if a company like Boeing, for instance, which is a fairly big employer in this state and which I believe does business with Iran, continue to do business with that country, would you advocate disinvestment from that company?
So the issue that came up that you're probably referring to on the campaign trail was the tax credits that we have. So the Treasurer's Office doesn't really administer tax credits, but Boeing is availing itself to the benefit of state tax credits right now. And the question was asked, do you believe that a company that's selling aircraft to Iran should be able to get tax credits? And my answer was very clear, which is I don't think any tax dollars should go to any company that does business with a state sponsor of terrorism. And let's be very clear about what it means to be on that list. We're talking about Iran, Sudan, and Syria. Okay, there are three countries that are on that list. And the reason why they're on that list is they provide cash to Hezbollah. They provide weapons to terrorists who kill American soldiers, who seek to wipe Israel off the map. And so I'm very sensitive to this. I mean, the reason why this is relevant now, this was sort of an issue that gained attention in the mid part of the 2000s, 2005-ish. Since then, there had been a lot of divestment from Iran. And they were, those sanctions were really working at the federal level and these state-based sanctions. In the Iran deal, though, paragraph 25 was specifically negotiated to not just lift the federal sanctions on Iran that opened up literally hundreds of billions of dollars and, you know, not to be sensational about it, but literally in the dead of night and a cargo plane with cash. I mean, this stuff is nuts to me, but it happened. So that happened at a federal level, but Iran negotiated successfully that they wanted these state-based sanctions lifted. And so in that paragraph, it says all available authorities will be used against the federal government, our federal government, against states that have policies that are inconsistent with the Iran treaty or the Iran deal, not the treaty, but the deal. So what does that mean? So that then it, because the Iran deal came to light last year, it became an issue in the campaign, and I've been steadfast.
Is it really an issue in Missouri? I mean, are there many companies that, in fact, do business with those three countries?
Well, we don't have any. If you're asking if we have any investments at the Treasurer's office, we don't with any of those companies that do business.
So I mean, what? Whether it's because there's entanglements with state sponsors of terrorism or for any other reason, are there investments that are currently being made with Missouri's funds that you have looked at and say this has to change?
Not in the Treasurer's office.
Okay.
Not with our $3.8 billion portfolio, but we intend to look very carefully at other funds.
Like what other funds? Like pension funds?
Pension funds, absolutely. Yeah. Mm. And that's not breaking news on this. I hate to break it. Not breaking news on this.
No, well,
we talked about
it
in the campaign, and quite frankly, it was a big.
Well, and a lot of states use their pension funds as activist investment tools.
Yeah, and I just think, look, I didn't meet a single person on the campaign trail that thought it was a good idea for their tax dollars to be funneled to the Ayatollah to help kill American soldiers.
Well, I don't think anybody thinks that.
Well, then this should be a unifying issue.
Sure. Are there
a controversial one.
Sure, I think that's probably right. Are there other industries or other nations that you would not want to see Missouri funds invested in?
Well, I've been steadfast on we're talking about anti-terror policy.
Is that it?
And that's where I'm at right now. This is about tax dollars being used to kill Americans and to, when you have death to America, when they chant death to America, they really mean it and they have it on their missiles. So this is a serious issue. I'm not talking about a political debate. I'm talking about people who are using those funds to do a lot of harm.
You've got debates in more liberal states like California around pension funds being invested in fossil fuel companies, for example. Obviously, I'm guessing that's not something you would
not
choose
on my
to
agenda.
Pursue
not
Missouri.
On my agenda.
Are there any other industries or issues that you think
this,
of that
I way? Don't view this as a playground for picking and choosing. I just think that we've had a very well-established anti-terror policy in this state for a long time. In the Treasurer's office, an internal policy that's been both with Republicans and Democrats. And I think that we need to maintain that integrity even in light of the Iran deal. And that's the reason why this has become an issue.
Can I go ahead?
Please, no, go one more question.
Turn the discussion to something that is very personal and dear to your heart and that you've spoken about publicly and that you referred to earlier, and that is your son and your championing of, while you were in the state Senate, of legislation that would benefit the disabled.
Mm-hmm.
Could you speak a little bit more about Stephen and what the nature of his condition is and about the legislation that you promoted?
Sure. So Stephen was born in 2004, and I was just a younger lawyer, was our first child. And at about 5 months, Stephen was diagnosed with a pretty rare genetic condition called tuberous sclerosis. I had never heard of it. It causes a lot of problems, tubers in different organs. So he has his heart behind his eyes, kidneys, and his brain where it's most affected. So he has lesions essentially all over his brain that manifest themselves in all kinds of problems. He has epilepsy. So Stephen has seizures nearly every day. Stephen's completely nonverbal and on the autism spectrum. So as a parent, before I ever even thought about running for office, really, that was my experience, and getting to know the people who helped with Stephen and their compassion, the other families that were dealing with these challenges and things that we just take for granted, navigating stairs, taking care of yourself, all those sorts of things that I'm very well aware of the challenges that individuals with disabilities face. And so Stephen really, for me, was my inspiration to run, to try to make a bigger impact, to make a difference. And that's why I ran. I ran for office in 2008. I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to be a voice for, I had a lot of, obviously we've talked about a bunch of them already, a lot of sort of beliefs in how I view the world, but really Stephen is my, my touchstone. I mean, he is, when I go home and look into his eyes, he is an inspiration for me to fight as hard as I can, to make as big of an impact as I can while I have the privilege to serve in an elected office. So when I got to the Senate, one of the first issues I worked on was autism insurance reform. It was the only bioneurological condition that was specifically excluded from insurance coverage. And there are, you know, literally thousands of kids now doing things because we worked in a bipartisan way to get that done, that are, you know, those kids now are doing things that they would never have done before. I carried that advocacy to work on things like, you know, more appropriate language in our statutes for people with developmental disabilities, to get rid of the word mentally retarded and have it more up to date. CBD oil, which is a marijuana extract for intractable epilepsy, that came from a family that moved to Colorado. I didn't think it was right that a family had to pick up their, leave their job and their support network and move to another state to access something that might work for them. The ABLE Act, which we did in 2015, which is, I think I mentioned it earlier, but a way for people to save for the long-term needs of a loved one with disability like they would for college. That came from a parent that I knew back in Kirkwood, where I'm from, who has a son with Down syndrome. And so I really enjoyed working on those issues because I felt like it was making a difference for real people. And so now as state treasurer, being able to administer that program, we're going to roll that out and get people enrolled. And
The ABLE Act.
Yeah, so that'll be something that we'll be doing this year that people can open up, have the peace of mind. I just know as a dad, and I know that we get into this, you know, gladiator style political stuff that certainly drives ratings on TV, but at the heart of it, we all bring our own life experiences to these offices. Mm-hmm. And for me, I'm a dad first. And advocating for individuals like Stephen is certainly a passion of mine.
One other thing I want to note, your Twitter feed reveals you to be a baseball fan.
Sorry,
though, to report that it shows you to root for the wrong baseball
team. Yeah. I'm not going to be a phony here. I am a diehard Cardinal fan, born and raised. But I do want the Royals to do well. But I think
you
want to
see
not
them in the World. You want to see another 1985.
That'd be great. Yeah, okay. That'd be great.
Who's going to win more games this year, the Cardinals or the Royals?
The Cardinals. I'll have to say the Cardinals. But I do root for the Royals. I want them to do well. The only thing that I regret, well, not personal regret,
but
I wish that in 95, the Royals were given the first shot to join the NL Central before the Brewers were. That would have been a fun cross-state rivalry. But I get it, more of a traditional American League town. But I think it's great. Look, I think it's great when the Royals are doing well. It's a great fan base, and they've had a great run. And I hope they can keep a lot of the talent that they've developed now and keep them here in Kansas City. It'd be great.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. Thanks to Dan Margulies for being part of the show today.
Thank you.
And thank you, Treasurer Eric Schmidt.
It was a great time. We'll have to do it again.
I hope so. Statehouse Blend Missouri is produced by Matt Hodapp. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you've already done that, you like the sound of things, please post a review. And don't forget, you can also find us on the NPR One app. Just search for us in Explore and tap Follow. If you use Twitter, keep up on the show that way. I'm at PTS Brian. My good friend and colleague from Statehouse Blend Kansas is at Sam Zeff. You can find a shorter version of us on the air on Tuesday mornings as part of Up to Date at 11 a.m. That's on KCUR 89.3. And if you have any other questions or ideas for the show, shoot me an email, brian@kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison. Thanks for listening.